Micah chapter 4. I'm going to put an image up on the screen. Olivia, would you go to the next slide, please? It didn't come through. Go to the next one. Oh, man. Everything came through the wrong way. That's no good. Not sure why that happened. The difficulty with Micah. It's a challenge reading the prophets, isn't it?
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks.
Part of the problem with reading the prophets is that you're going to see things as you're reading that are future to a prophet, but are not necessarily future to us. So some of these events have already occurred in the past. So I will get to this, and I have no idea why everything is backwards on there. But you got to think about it. What Micah is going to look ahead in chapter 4 and chapter 5. He's going to look ahead, and he's going to see a whole bunch of things coming from his perspective. And it's sort of like looking at a submarine that's coming straight at you. So the picture on the right-hand side, which ignore the fact that it says Jesus return and kingdom comes, because for some reason it inverted everything on my slide. But if you just look at the submarine picture on the right-hand side, this is a picture of the submarine coming directly at a person, right? And so if a submarine were moving directly towards you, it would look almost two-dimensional, wouldn't it? If it was coming straight at you, it would look like all the different pieces are going to arrive at the same time. And that's sort of what the phenomenon that Micah is experiencing as he views the vision that God gives him of what the future is going to look like and the promises that he is offering his people. It looks two-dimensional. It looks like everything is going to come at the same time. And then the reality is that experience doesn't actually play out for the people. What happens for the people is that these things get fulfilled in different stages, and it's almost like the submarine begins to move past Micah, and suddenly it hits Jesus, and there's more fulfillment there, and then we move past Jesus, the submarine keeps moving through time, as it were, and more parts approach, but we're still waiting for that final fulfillment. But the trouble is we're now going back to Micah. And we're going to read what Micah had to say about this. And it becomes difficult to distinguish what part of the submarine has already passed us and what part is still to come. And what are we to take from this text as a whole? So it is a challenge that I'm going to hope to unpack for us this morning a little bit, but it's not easy. And so if you've been reading Micah in your spare time and in your devotional time, you can just appreciate some of the challenge that the prophets present to us. Because they're just not easy reading. It's some of the most difficult reading in all of Scripture. And part of it is it has to do with where are we at in the submarine? You know, how much of this is past and how much of it is still to come? So we're going to unpack that this morning because this entire passage is about looking forward. So let's begin at verse 9 of chapter 4. Micah is addressing Judah, the southern kingdom. They're about to go into exile. He says, "Now why do you cry aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished? That pains have seized you like a woman in childbirth or in labor. Writhe and groan, O daughter Zion, like a woman in labor, for you are about to go forth from the city of Jerusalem and camp in the open country on your way into captivity in Babylon." That's bad news. But the next line says, "There you shall be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hands of your enemies." Let's pause there. We've talked in the previous weeks about why it is that they are going into Babylon. Primarily, Micah would say it's because they've been abusing the poor, either by neglecting them or by stealing from them. And we talked in other weeks about how we do the same thing. We neglect the poor. We don't think about it. We neglect the vulnerable. Or we steal from them simply by not giving. And we are commanded to give. I'm not going to unpack that again. You'd have to go back and listen to other week's messages. But we do the same thing. And the question is, of course, if we do the same thing as the audience that Micah addresses, then might we expect the same result from God? That's an open question. Now, Micah says that exile is coming because of what they have been through. So my question for you, and this is more rhetorical, I'm just going to ask it and then I'm going to leave it there. But, you know, what if God at one point says to Western society, enough's enough. You've gotten rich off the poor countries for long enough. What if that happens? And the reason I ask that question, I don't have a solution for it. I don't have an answer for it. So I'm not going to preach it because it's hard to preach something you just don't have an answer for. But I'm not entirely sure if Micah would feel like his words were represented fairly if we simply boiled down his message to give a little more at Christmas time. That the prophets just have a little more teeth than that. And so I want to throw out that rhetorical question. At the same time, that's not where the passage lands. So Micah announces the judgment is coming, but then right after that he says, but that's not going to be the end. In exile, you will be rescued. And that's where he continues on. He says it's not going to be permanent. Now, it will be permanent for most of those who experience it. Exile lasted at least 70 years, so most of the people with a lifespan of 30 or 40 years, 40 would be excellent in that day and age, so they're all going to die in exile. But the hope that he's offering them is that it won't be the end for the people as a whole. God will continue with the people even though they've been faithless. God will continue. But then he promises them something else, and here's where we get into a message that really does overlap with Christmas. Or with the stories that we typically read at Christmas time. God promises them not just something else, not just rescue, but someone else who is going to rescue them. In fact, it's going to be a king. And it's going to be a familiar passage that you know. Read on. Chapter 5, verse 2. But you, O Bethlehem, of some unpronounceable name, who are you of the little clans of Judah? From you shall come forth for me one who is to rule Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore, he shall give them up until that time when she who is in labor has brought forth a child. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. Then they shall live secure, for he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be one of peace. Micah sees that after exile, there is a new king coming. And this is good news for them. It's a new king from the line of David who's going to take the throne because, of course, they lost their king during the exile. Now, if you remember the account in Matthew, it's not technically a Christmas account, but we end up including it with Christmas, you know, the story of the wise men. Right? The wise men come to Jerusalem, and they're looking there. They go to Jerusalem because that's the capital city, and that's where the king is. And they say, they go to the king, who happens to be Herod, and they say, we've seen this star. We know that the king of the Jews has been born. So, where is he? We're here to worship the king. And Herod panics because no king has been born in his house, right? And so he calls the priests together and he says, where's the Messiah going to be born? And this is the passage in Micah that the priests quote. They quote back to him. This is in Matthew. They quote this back to him and they say, he's going to come from the line of David and he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Right? The problem is, the challenge for us as we read Micah is that as we're moving along through the submarine of time, right, as it's beginning to pass, it's not being fulfilled in exactly the ways that they were expecting it to happen, right? That the birth in Bethlehem and the line of David, that gets fulfilled the way that everyone expects it to, right? But then after that, none of the rest of this passage actually looks a lot like Jesus for those who were expecting something different. So, Olivia, would you go to the slide that has the chart, please? Thank you. Here's what they were expecting. They were expecting someone who was going to gather the people. Micah 5:3 says, the people shall return. They are expecting that. For those who have been scattered by the exile, right, they're taken off to Babylon, they're taken away from the land, they're expecting that when this king comes, he is going to gather all of these people from exile. Because, of course, even in Jesus' day, most of the Jewish people lived outside of the land of Palestine. They were taken into exile, and they stayed in exile. And so the people reading Micah's prophecy are expecting that Jesus, their Messiah, is going to gather all of the people together back into the land. And of course, Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus fulfills this at a much deeper level. Jesus has to deal with the exile, not of being outside of the land, but being far from God. The exile of sin and death. The exile of all of the people who have become almost spiritually oppressed by a corrupt religious system that keeps them far away from God. So Jesus comes announcing, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Jesus comes and eats with the sinners, the people who were far from God. Jesus accomplishes a different return from exile, and it is so much deeper and so much more profound than simply getting the people back together in their land. But that's not what they were expecting. And so you have to understand that for Jewish people today, for example, who say Jesus is not the Messiah, they're not saying that because they're stupid, okay? Jesus is not the type of king that they were looking for. It's not what they were expecting. That's not to say it wasn't fulfilled. I certainly do believe that. But it is to at least give them a little bit of credit that they're not being silly or stupid or ignorant or anything like that. So let's read this with a little bit of humility as well. But nevertheless, Jesus does accomplish a return from exile. He starts it. Next one, it says that they are expecting a ruler, a king, in verses 2 and 4. A shepherd is just a metaphor for a king. It's used constantly in the ancient world. They're expecting a king. But of course, they're expecting a particular type of king. They're not expecting the type of king that Jesus claims to be. They're expecting the type of king who's going to be essentially a Jewish Caesar. Caesar brought peace, right? How do you bring peace? He used a sword, a whole lot of them, and a whole lot of crosses as well. Crucifixion was very, very common in the ancient world for all the people who opposed Caesar, right? They are expecting that, they think Micah is promising that they are going to have a king who is going to take over and become the next Jewish Caesar, essentially. And of course, Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus is king, but where does he reign from? Heaven first, but when he comes, he reigns from a cross. And they post it above his head, don't they? This is the king of the Jews. It's a different type of king. It's a different type of kingdom too, isn't it? Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Not that it won't have anything to do with this world, but it's not going to look the same way kingdoms normally look for these people. But of course, this isn't what they were expecting. I love this verse though. "Fear not, little flock," Jesus says. "It's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." He's going to give his Jewish people a kingdom, but it's going to look very different. Jesus, of course, will also say at the end of the gospel, "All authority in heaven and on earth," this is kingly language, right, "has been given to me." He is a king, and he does fulfill this, but he fulfills these things at a deeper level and in a different way than what they were expecting. Next line, it says, "They shall live secure," verse 4. Micah is expecting that these people are going to stop being on the bottom of the pile for a change, because, of course, they go into exile, and so Babylon are their rulers. Babylon gets kicked out, then Persia becomes their rulers. Then Persia gets kicked out by the next country or set up group of people that gets control of the entire known world, and that's the Greek people. And then after that comes Rome and Caesar, and the Jewish people never get a chance to be on top. And of course, Jesus comes, and he doesn't kick out the Romans, does he? These poor people, this is what they've been waiting for. This is what they've been putting all their hope in. And they're basing it on Micah. They're basing it on their scriptures, right? And it doesn't look like it. "They shall live secure." But of course, Jesus brings a different type of security, doesn't he? Right? Jesus says, "And this is the will of him who sent me, that I shall lose none of those he has given me." There's security there. "I shall lose none of those whom he has given me, but I will raise them up on the last day." They will have security. We will have security. But it's not the type that they were expecting. They're looking for worldwide peace in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 5 of Micah. Worldwide peace and prosperity. He will be the one of peace. Jews at the top, once again, offering prosperity to those, to everyone who gets in line. Right? Jesus comes and brings a different type of peace. And he gets it a different way, doesn't he? He has to lay down his life. And he teaches all of his followers to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This is a different type of king. And then he models it by dying for his enemies. Micah is fulfilled, but it's fulfilled in a different way. And of course, we are still awaiting the completion of this, aren't we? Right? We have promises that have been made, and they have been fulfilled in Jesus, but not completely. And we're waiting for that. I'll open it up for Q&A in just a minute if you want to clarify that a little bit. But the submarine continues to move, right? We're at a different point in time. And so some of these are past, and some of these are yet to come. We are still waiting for Jesus' uncontested rule, when all authority in heaven and on earth that has been given to him is seen most clearly in absolutely every single aspect of our lives. That's what we're still waiting for. And we can trust Micah and trust Jesus that that actually will be fulfilled. And that's part of what Advent involves. That's why we're taking the time to go through Micah during Advent, because we're putting ourselves into the position of reminding ourselves that there is still something better coming. We've had Jesus the first time, and he's certainly made quite a difference, but we're still waiting for the completion of that as well. And we need to be waiting for that, anticipating that, reminded of the fact that this is still to come. As good as our lives may be, something better is in store. And it has to do with Jesus fulfilling these things in Micah and the things that he has promised us. So that song that we sang this morning that piggybacks on the Lord's Prayer, right? Your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for Jesus to bring that. So, this is going to be a very short message if you don't have questions or some comments or something to interact over. But what out of this still leaves you with questions? What would you like to clarify? James is going to start us off, then Liam. Fire away, James. Sorry, could you say your question again? Does it mean that that's the... Yes, it's a different return from... It's a different, maybe a way of clarifying it would be to say it's a rescue from sin and death, which is what a rescue out of exile is. So the exile, the problem is we're stuck in the land of Babylon. That's what they're thinking, right? Jesus going, actually, no, the problem is that you're being oppressed not by the Babylonians. You're being oppressed by sin and death and the powers that keep us in the realm of sin and death. And so Jesus needs to deal with that far deeper problem. So it may be a different way of phrasing this to clarify it a little bit for you is to change the word from return from exile to say rescue from exile, because we're being rescued. You're not being rescued from Babylon. You're being rescued from a far deeper enemy, sin, death, the powers of darkness, right? Does that help? Great. Thanks for letting me clarify that. Well done. Thanks for paying attention. Liam. So Liam is asking me to clarify the submarine analogy, which would have worked a lot better if my visuals had worked properly, for which I apologize. Liam is asking, once again, whether or not Micah actually saw sort of the depth, the amount of time that it was going to take for these things to be fulfilled. That's your question, right? So my quick answer to that is no, it does not appear that Micah actually understood that this was going to take a whole lot longer, that this was a much longer submarine coming than what he thought. It really doesn't look that way. And the reason we don't think that Micah saw it in that way or thought in that way is because of all of the expectations that people then had about what they could expect when the exile was over. And they're waiting for this particular type of king, right? And it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen. So when the priests quote Micah, what So when I talked about the story of the wise men coming to Herod, and they quote to Herod that the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem, quoting Micah, right? That was 700 years from the time of the priests, 700 years ago, that Micah had made that prophecy. They had no idea it was going to take that long. No. Oh, okay. Thanks for clarifying that. Who else would like to follow the lead of our young gentleman here and ask a question or make a comment? Lionel. Yeah. So Lionel is asking for a little bit of clarification on Micah's current time period and when the southern kingdom of Judah would be taken over by Babylon versus when the northern kingdom had been taken over and gone into their own particular exile and judgment. So the northern, Micah is making this prophecy roughly around, as I said, about 700, you know, give or take. The reason we know that is because Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah, and they were prophesying to the king Hezekiah primarily. So that's how we know we can date this thing, because that's roughly when his ministry was taking place. So you're looking at the time period of King Hezekiah. So that means that in terms of your northern kingdom that you asked about, the kingdom of Israel, Samaria, we talked about that in the first week, that they had their judgment when the Assyrians came in and basically destroyed the northern kingdom, repopulated it with other people that they had taken over in other parts of the world. They brought them to that land, and they wiped out the northern kingdom. That happened in 722 BC, so you're looking 20-odd years before the prophecy we're currently talking about. And that's one of the reasons, as we mentioned in previous weeks, why Micah says to his southern kingdom listeners, don't forget what happened to those people. Don't forget what happened to the northern kingdom, because if you don't shape up, God will use a different kingdom to come in and deal with you. And so the prophecy we are dealing with today is happening right on the very edge of that, the very edge of, actually it's not the edge, sorry. He's saying it's going to come. And it would have come, but if you actually start reading in 2 Kings what happens with Hezekiah, Hezekiah turns things around. So Hezekiah didn't start out as a great king, and we know that from the fact that Micah's delivering these prophecies. But all the stuff that you then get in 2 Kings about Hezekiah's reforms, and the judgment gets put off, and Babylon doesn't actually come until well after Hezekiah's reign, because he listened. He listened to the king. Or, sorry, he listened to the prophet. So, thanks for asking that. Anyone else want to share? Comment? Question? Corey, I'll come back to you, Kent. Corey, I don't think it's going to be long before you're going to be up here. Well done. Yeah, I think that's just a brilliant, brilliant point that I love the fact that you are hearing, you are putting yourself in the same position that Micah's rich audience was in, where in previous weeks we talked about he calls them out on this stuff and they have very hard hearts. Because they're on the top. And you know what? We're on the top, my friends. Like almost all of us, if not all of us, are on the very top when we're talking world scale. And that's what really disturbs me about the prophets here. Because I'm not the one in the position to be receiving the promise of hope. I'm a little bit more in the position of you've been on top and you better make sure you're taking care of the poor or this is coming. I'm feeling the teeth of that, and I'm sorry if I'm bringing that out and that's making you uncomfortable, but I think that's Micah's point. And that's why I asked my rhetorical question at the beginning, because I think we need to hear that. We really do. So I appreciate that you are already putting yourself in that position of saying, no, I need to be a little bit more sensitive to exactly what Micah is addressing, because I think he's addressing me. I think he is. And I felt that sting this week. Thanks, Corey. Kent. It is and it isn't, right? Well done. That's a great question, Kent. Kent's question is, he says, I'm seeing that at Jesus' second coming up here on the chart, Jesus is going to fulfill these prophecies in ways that we have not yet experienced. And yet at the same time, Jesus at the cross says, it is finished. Now, the only way you can keep those two things together is to say that what Jesus finished at the cross guarantees that this is coming. We can't in good conscience say we have already received everything that has been promised, right? I don't think even Jesus would say that. But what Jesus has done at the cross, and Paul will talk about this in terms of the Spirit, in Galatians especially, where he will say that this is the deposit guaranteeing what is to come. It's the same thing about the cross, and what Jesus does at the cross is the absolute guarantee that this is coming. There is a second coming, where Jesus is going to bring to completion all of the things that we are being promised in Scripture. So, thanks for that, Kent. I'm gonna stop there, but we can always continue the conversation afterwards. Yep. Finish your sermon, preacher. Thank you for that. Great interactions. Well done. Great questions. I love that you're tracking with this stuff and thinking it through and applying it. That's great. Let's look at verse 7 and following. What we've talked about so far, what Micah has been saying so far, has to do with what God is going to do for his people. But the next step in this passage talks about what God is going to do with his people. So please hear that as we read further along. Then the remnant of Jacob, God's people who survived the exile and following. The remnant of Jacob, surrounded by many peoples, i.e. peoples who are outside of the Jewish people, people who do not follow Yahweh. Then the remnant of Jacob, surrounded by these Gentile peoples, shall be like the dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which do not depend on people or wait for any mortal. And among the nations, the remnant of Jacob, surrounded by many peoples, shall be like a lion among the animals of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which, when it goes through, treads down and tears in pieces with no one to deliver. Your hand shall be lifted over your adversaries, and your enemies shall be cut off. We'll stop there, but the judgment actually continues through that passage. Micah sees two things happening. He sees blessing and he sees judgment. Now, when you start at the passage that talks about God's going to make you like dew and rain. And I think we have a lot of soggy, wet Christians who don't actually get that you're actually supposed to be bringing life to people and not despair. But the idea of making you like dew and rain, like this was absolute blessing. It was what they needed. This is an agricultural culture, right? And if you know their climate, they only get rain twice a year. Season at the beginning, season at the end, whole long period where there's nothing coming. And God says, I will make you the very thing that these people need the most. Have you thought of yourself as the dew and the rain, the blessing that brings life? And without you, things will not actually grow and flourish in their lives. And we're talking about the lives of the people outside of this building. That's the promise that God says he is going to make his people, you, me. Now the question is, where does that happen on the submarine? Right? Is that something we're still waiting for? I think it's now, friends. Like when Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world, you are the things that these people need the most, I think it's now. God wants to make you someone who brings people life. Do you have that effect on people? Do you bring them life by being around them? Do we ask God to make us this kind of blessing to the people who don't know him? We should. Now, the second image is the image of a lion having its way among the flock. And God says he will make his people a means of judgment. And Jesus says the same thing, actually. He tells his apostles they're going to sit on 12 thrones judging the people. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 6, says, don't you know that you are going to, speaking to the church, you are going to judge the world and the angels? Of course, the question is then, where's that on the submarine? That, I suggest, is future, not present. So be very careful. Let us be very careful. I need to be very careful that I'm not currently judging the people outside of this building, because that is not the time for it. We're at different places here in the submarine in the text, right? Paul says, don't you know that you will judge the world and the angels? Not yet. Not yet. For now, we only judge those inside this building. And as Jesus says, only after we have first checked ourselves, right? The old plank in the eye versus sawdust in someone else's, right? Why judgment, though? Benjamin, this is supposed to be a happy time. It's Christmas, right? It's not Christmas. It's Advent, and that's different, okay? Advent is about getting ready for Jesus' return, and that is a chance to check ourselves, which we need to do, and some of you have been doing that this morning, and well done. We need to be checking ourselves to make sure that we are not neglecting the poor and hoarding our wealth. We need to be asking ourselves if we are the dew and rain that our dry culture needs. We need to be asking ourselves that God would make us that now. Now, I don't know how much more of this submarine is left to come, but this stuff, the judgment is still good news. Nonetheless, it's good news because it means that one day God is going to deal with everything cancerous in our world. He will, and he will work it out. Everything that has become an enemy of life, God is going to deal with. And that's the good news that the prophet is looking forward to. And Advent is about waiting for that joy to come, because there is joy ahead.